In this episode of the New York Baseball Podcast, Wally and I have two guests on today. We have Meredith Marakovitz, and we also have SNY's Nelson Figueroa. We're going to cover both teams from different aspects, and it's going to be a great one.
Two great guests, two people who know their teams inside and out, and I really am looking forward to talking to Meredith because she'll give us some real behind-the-scenes stuff about covering the Yankees.
A lot of behind-the-scenes stuff, a lot of what goes on the plane with the athletes, and we'll also talk to Nelson Figueroa about what has gone wrong and what we can look forward to in 2019. A quick note, if you enjoy this podcast, don't forget to go out, subscribe, go out and like it, go out and leave a comment, do everything possible under the sun so we can keep the lights on and keep doing this every single week. Here it is, the New York Baseball Podcast. All right, we're back for another episode of the New York Baseball Podcast with the usual suspects, Dan Canobio and Mr. Wallace Matthews. And believe it or not, Wally, the sun did come up. The Yankee season is still going on because a lot of people thought it ended on Sunday night when the Yankees got beat for the fourth time in a row, fifth time in five games.
The chase of the AL East title probably ended.
Yeah, so that's the funny thing is, like, it felt, I don't know if a lot of fans feel this. I know you're not a fan, you're a reporter.
Thank you.
But a lot of times after the season ends for the Yankees, when you wake up that morning last year when the playoffs are over, you kind of think like, oh, man, baseball's over. Season ended. I kind of felt that way like on Monday morning because the way you hear about this is like the season's over. The Yankees are done. Four-game losing streak, five-game losing streak.
But that's not true.
I know. That's what I'm saying. Like, I want to let everyone know that the sun has risen. The Yankees won a game in Chicago. They're still in the wild card lead, but then maybe they're not going to win a division.
By a little bit.
Two and a half games.
Yeah.
The A's are coming back into it. But the moral of the story is that the season is still going on. The Yankees have time to figure things out.
Yeah, but the difference is they're chasing a team that's on a historic pace.
Mm-hmm.
All right? The Red Sox have not had a down period yet.
No, they've had like maybe like a little like a they had a little soft streak where the Yankees were able to catch up to them after that 17-1 start.
You know, I haven't checked, but have they even lost more than three games in a row?
I don't know.
I'm
trying to keep track of what the Yankees and Mets do. But
so that's the problem. I mean, I know the Yankees have a lot of bad teams in front of them now,
right.
But they got to hope that the Red Sox stumble. There's six games left between the two teams,
mm-hmm.
which is not enough, obviously, to make up a 9-game deficit. So you got to hope that the Red Sox stumble and that you basically cannot afford any more cold spells.
Yeah, one thing is that I know the Red Sox are playing more teams over 500 than the Yankees. I believe the Red Sox have 27 games
slightly
remaining.
Yeah, but
the Yankees have 22 remaining. The Yankees' next 27 games are against teams under 500.
Yeah, but even if you assume that the Yankees win all six games against the Red Sox, it's a huge assumption, okay?
Huge, yeah. Especially
you still have
after
to make up three
weekend.
Games somewhere else, which
yeah.
means you can't afford to go into any tailspins, and you have to hope the Red Sox do. It's a lot to ask.
I think the smart thing to do if you're a Yankee fan is to, and the Yankees as a franchise, they should just now focus on themselves. Focus on what's going on inside that clubhouse. Try
That's
to get Severino right. Right. Try to get Severino right. Get Sanchez back. Get Judge back. You know, get some more mojo working with Glaber. And get Andujar back on track. Maybe don't focus on the Red Sox so much. And now kind of look forward to just trying to getting what you can control. And that's going out there and winning every single night.
You know, our producer, Nick Canobio, is telling me that they lost two in a row is the most
wow.
that the Red Sox have lost all season.
That reminds me of the 98 team. I think they started, 1-4?
Yeah, I think they had had one three-game losing streak.
They went 1-4, then maybe in September. What are you saying, Nick?
There's been one three-game
losing streak.
The Red Sox have had one
three-game losing streak. Yeah, they're basically winning seven out of every 10 games.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's not going to get it done. You
yeah.
need them to lose. You know, they have to lose, like, five in a row. The Yankees just came off a five-game losing streak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they've had others in the past, and one thing you have to realize is that over the last 40 games, the Yankees are like a 500 team.
Yeah, they're actually 19-20 over their last. Nick, add that up for me.
That's 39 games.
39 games. I'm trying to think of way too many things.
19 and 20
is 39. Carry the one.
Yeah.
So I have this little stat here.
It's not good.
Not good. Not what you want, as George
no.
Roy would say. We have this. This little nugget here that I saw on Sweeney Murdy's Twitter. We also have to get on the podcast soon.
Oh, without a doubt.
2017, the Yankees last year, they started off 21-9. From that game forward, the 30th game on, they went 50-54. Mm-hmm. So they fell into a little tailspin, as we're seeing right now. They finished up 2017.
50 and 54 is not a little tail. That's more than half the season.
Right, that's what the Yankees are in right now. The third of the season, the Yankees are, like we said, are 19 and 21. They finished last year, the Yankees, they finished September 20 and 8.
Right.
Which got them the wild card, and we all know how that season ended.
That's fine. But even if they were to do that, let's say they go into September, nine games out. If they were to go 20 and 8, they need the Red Sox to go, you know.
Yeah, they kind of have to just forget about the.
Would just cancel it out for the Red Sox.
Yeah, but the way you listen to talk radio and you look at Twitter, people think
I don't do either.
People think that they're not even going to make the playoffs. They think the season's over. But if you look at this year, the Yankees started off 9 and 9, and then they went on a ridiculous 41 and 13 stretch, which is 759 baseball, and now they're in this 19 and 20 tailspin.
Listen, we know they're a good team, all right? They're a very good team. They are still, what, 28 games or 29 games over 500?
27 now.
27 games over. That's a very good team.
Not good enough.
However, they are chasing a historically good team.
Yeah.
So that just may be, you know, it may just be fate, you know what I'm saying? It may just not be your year, even though the Yankees may very well win 100 games.
How about this? Now, we look forward that the Red Sox go on to this historic pace. Let's say they win 112, 113 games. Let's say they even break the record. Yankees get to the wild card game as they should. They win the wild card game. You know, they get to the ALDS now. It's Yankees versus Red Sox. Red Sox have all the pressure on them because they have the record for most wins or have had an historic season. Yankees go back to the little engine that could. Yankees go back to the underdog, which I liked so much last year, 2017.
I love it. Nice narrative. It's all baloney.
that's just something I've thought of. Just something that's out there.
Because the pressure is going to be the same on all of them when they get to October because everybody starts at zero.
You don't think that the Red Sox with the highest payroll and 114 wins will have even more added pressure to win?
If anything, I would think they would have more confidence thinking, hey, we're the best team in baseball we have been all year and we will continue to be. Well, that's the way I would think. The opposite to me would be a loser's mentality.
Well, look at the Mariners in 2001. They had the most wins. They ended up losing to the Yankees. Look at
it happens.
The Yankees in 1988, they had so much pressure on. They went down two games to one.
It happens because baseball can be very random. Right. You know, it's not like boxing. You know, you cover boxing too. To me, I've always felt that at when you get to the highest level of boxing, 99 out of 100 times, the better fighter is going to win.
Right.
Lucky things are not going. There's no such thing as a lucky punch. You know, if you're not good enough, you're not going to win. Baseball is different. Things are random. Guys get hurt. The ball takes a bad hop. A guy makes a bad call. The umpire punches you out when it should have been ball four. A lot of things can happen that don't have anything to do with the abilities of the two teams.
I'm looking for ways for Yankee fans to realize that the sky is not falling. I want to see – I really want
maybe
to see
Yankees – maybe the sky is falling.
Who knows? I mean, we don't know. That's another thing that I tweeted out earlier in the week or over the weekend when the Yankees were getting beat down by the Red Sox was everyone wants this under-30 team. Everyone wants this young team with 21-year-old phenoms.
Right.
I'm using quotes here and all these studs. But do you really want to have to deal with some of the warts that come along with a young team?
Well, but there's warts with older teams as well. We've seen it. I mean, listen.
Well, at least with the old teams, you have a track record and you know what to expect. Like, but now with this young team, no one knows that Gleyber Torres, after he makes a big error and has a bad game, he's kind of going to go into a little
bit
of a malaise. Exactly.
Doesn't that make it interesting?
Of course. It makes it worth watching.
I can't wait to see, in fact, quite frankly, I can't wait to see how Aaron Boone reacts to his first real stretch of adversity here.
100% agree with you.
So far, he's been very positive about it. But, I mean, if they keep falling, if let's say they fall behind in the wild card race.
Oof.
What's he going to say then?
I'm really interested in that because for the Yankees this season, for Aaron Boone, it's been all smooth sailing. He had that one hiccup early on in Toronto where he didn't pitch to smoke at the home run.
Right.
Other than that, there were a few.
Pitch to Donaldson.
Other than that, the only complaints have been, you know, maybe with a little bullpen management here and there, arresting guys. But now he's in a full-fledged crisis when you lose four in a row to the Red Sox. And you're right, Wally, down the stretch. Should the Yankees continue to kind of hover around here, stay within two games, and don't really separate themselves even more from whoever the second wild card team is, it's going to be very interesting to see if Boone still keeps that, you know, everything is great vibe.
Well, let me give you real reasons for the Yankee fans not to think that the sky is falling. If they hold on to win the wild card, they have been, I don't know if they still are, if they haven't checked in the past couple of days, the hardest team to beat at home.
I think the Red Sox now have the best record at home.
But you know, it's very, very difficult.
Weekend, right.
Very difficult to beat the Yankees.
I wouldn't
at
be
home.
Surprised if the Yankees have the second best home record.
They probably do. They are built to play in that ballpark.
Yep.
Right? at this point, or maybe in an, I wrote this column 10 days ago and it probably was premature, but now I think it's perfectly legitimate. It's time to start setting up to get your best pitcher to pitch that game.
Of course.
All right? And whoever that turns out to be, if it's not Severino right now.
Right now it's Tanaka, in my opinion.
If it's Tanaka, if it's Jay Happ, if it's Lynn, if it's Lance Lynn, who pitched terrifically last night.
Roger Clemens 2.0?
Yeah, really. I mean, you know, what you do is now you start counting backwards from October 2nd. How do I get this guy to that game?
Right.
You know, and how do I get my bullpen ready so I have all my arms fresh for that game? Because that's all you got to do is win that game. Mm-hmm. And then from there, everybody's on an equal footing, and we go play baseball.
Yeah, you saw that a lot last year when the Yankees got past the wild card game. That was tough. It was a clean slate. They went down two games to the Indians. We all know what happened. We don't have to revisit there. But as for the Mets, while we have a very big guest.
Who are they?
The New York Metropolitans.
Oh, yes, them.
They're telling us that 2019 is going to be the year where they can compete. And Jeff Rico is telling us that we're not trading everyone. We're not going down and blowing this thing up. We have some assets on this team.
Well, don't forget, John Rico's talking for Jeff Wilpon.
Right.
So whatever he's saying, Jeff Wilpon's right behind him, like with his hand up his back, like he's a ventriloquist.
Well, that's why we had to get Nelson Figueroa on the podcast, someone that does not pull any punches, someone that doesn't listen to the narratives.
Nobody's dummy. Nobody's marionette.
Exactly. That's why we're really excited to have Nelson Figueroa on the podcast to kind of break down what's going on with the Mets. And I really wanted to get him on to look forward to what this team actually has going forward. We all know about Madoff and Wilpon and this, that, and the other, not trading him. But how about we look forward to 2019 to see if, you know, we can actually believe the Rico when he says that the Rico, I just called when
the
he
Rico
the Rico when he believes
he's not big enough to be the Rico yet.
Not yet, no. And right now he's just I wouldn't even know John Rico if he like punched me in the face on the side of the street.
Actually, I would. He's actually
never
tried to punch me in the face.
Oh, has he?
No, he hasn't.
Well, him and Don LaGreca have both tried to punch
Don's
me in the face.
Never tried. But he sounds like he might.
Yeah. So I think you're trying to make a point about the Mets.
The point about the Mets is that I don't remember what it was. Something about the Rico?
Yeah, the fact that we want to see what they have in 2019.
I think absolutely, because we've seen what they have in 2018, and it ain't much.
Yeah, so we'll get to Nelson Figueroa. We also have Meredith Marakovitz.
Oh, my favorite. Actually, my favorite person to hang out with in the Yankee clubhouse.
Yeah, really interesting stuff.
Somebody who's she's on top of everything. She knows the players better than anybody in there because she talks to them all like a friend, you know? Not, you know, she's a great reporter, but she also has a rapport with them.
She's friendly.
She's very
friendly.
That's
what I got away from
Yeah,
she's very like a people person.
She's very personable, and she does have a way of creating a rapport with players that, you know, you and I couldn't do.
Yeah.
Because, you know, obviously I'm there for a different purpose, but she does a terrific job at what she does.
Yeah, well, let's go to Mr. Nelson Figueroa, who will tell us about the Mets.
Okay, Dan, now it's been a roller coaster Mets season, obviously. It started out so promisingly, and now, you know, it is where it is, and I don't even know how to characterize it, but a man who gets paid to do that for SNY, a former major league pitcher, a guy who's pitched all over the world, including Citi Field and Shea Stadium, and he's a terrific commentator for SNY, joins the NYNY Baseball Podcast right now, Nelson Figueroa. Nelson, thanks so much for coming on with us today.
My pleasure, guys. How are you?
We're doing all right, man. But, you know, you heard in the intro what I said. It's been an up-and-down season for the Mets. Started out so well, 11-1. In a way, I guess it was an illusion. And, you know, those of us who looked at it weren't sure what to believe, what not to believe. Now, could you have foreseen how badly the season has gone since then?
Oh, no, without a doubt. When you started off 11-1, and I think everything that could go right did go right. You know, Familia saving, seven out of the first 10 games, just clicking on all cylinders almost. You didn't even have, you know, the big hitters batting for high averages. They were just getting big, timely hits, and they were able to – the bullpen was rock solid. The starting pitching was really the weak link at the time because they were only going five innings. So it was almost like fool's gold. But when you're winning 11 out of 12 games, you know, people – tend to buy in and want to believe that that's something that was going to be sustainable. You know, winning baseball, there's a million different ways to win a ball game, and you were hoping that this was just one facet of what they could do. Only problem was it seemed like the only facet of what they could do as the season wore on and the injuries started to mount, and that the underachievements and, you know, the performances weren't as expected.
Nelson, how difficult is it for you to sit behind the desk at SNY and, you know, talk about what you're seeing there? I mean, you know, obviously you don't want to paint too terrible a picture for the fans, but the same way, you know, they're not stupid and you can't lie to them. So how do you walk that tightrope?
Well, you know what? The freedom that they give us at SNY is to be honest. It's to be opinionated and have ways to back your opinion. It doesn't matter if it's right or wrong. It's your opinion. You can't possibly know what's inside someone's head. So when it comes to managerial decisions, when it comes to players coming up in a certain situation, you know, you try to use your, you know, experiences and go back to when, you know, you might have been in a similar situation, or the typical, you know, what would you have done kind of thing. And I have to lay it out for the fans. These are the options available. Was it the best option? Hindsight is always going to be 20/20, and I'm rarely going to be wrong. That's just the way it is. But at the same time, I have to acknowledge that even in an attempt to do something differently, maybe different than we've ever seen it done before, which Mickey has done a numerous amount of times, you have to explain to the average fan, or even the above average fan, who is used to things being done a certain way, this is the idea behind it. Now, when it works, whether it works in the short term or the long term, that's yet to be seen. But there's a managerial style with Mickey, players as well, with seeing guys like Michael Conforto. You know, he has these 10-game stretches where he seems like the all-star caliber hitter that I believe he is. And then he has 10 games where it seems like there's something wrong, or is he overmatched? Is the league adjusting to him? You know, the shifts have really done a number on him. You go back and forth, and it almost seems like that to every single player. 10-game spurts seem to be how you can look at this team, and that 10-game spurt metric isn't going to get it done. You need guys that can be consistent, like a Cabrera, throughout the course of a season. It's not just, you know, a matter of 10 games.
Now, Nelson, you say that the SNY, the producers and everyone in those decision-makers, they let you say what you want to say. So I know you're very opinionated. And obviously the Mets season hasn't, you know, gone the way they wanted. Do you feel like you get feedback that sometimes maybe a lot of these guys are too negative? Or what type of feedback do you get? Because as we know with this Mets fan base, it's kind of like gotten to the point where everyone just likes to egg on it, and it's the same thing, you know, on a nightly basis.
Well, yeah, and that's a difficult thing because, I mean, those guys in the booth have seen it all through the years. I mean, you're not going to, you know, slip something by Gary Cohen and say that, you know, something happened when it didn't. You can't fool those guys. They've seen too much baseball. They've played too much baseball. I think that's honestly where it stands with the fans. It's not about being negative. It's about showing what happened and trying to find a positive way that it can help even a negative outcome in that one game. Mm-hmm. How did you learn from it? Do you keep making the same mistakes? Do you keep doing the same things without learning from them? And that goes from a rookie player. It goes from, you know, a veteran player. It goes to the manager and coaches as well. The team has to grow, and you have to find growth at some point, and that's what you're looking for, especially in a lost season. This last month and a half, they've got to figure out what do they have going into next year. And that, I think, is the most important part right now, is the evaluation of the players that you have here, not, you know, looking to burn out some of the known commodities that are under contracts for next year, but rather than see what's down there in the farm system, see what you have in some of these young players like a McNeil, who, you know, has done a very nice job. And again, we talk about 10-day spurts. He hasn't been up here very long. But you kind of like seeing these younger players show what they can do, so that there isn't a doubt, hey, he's never done it at the big league level before. So I think that's really where we're at, is we're trying to show the fans the truest and our most honest sense of what's going on inside each and every game, and not trying to spin it positively. There's no way you can spin a lot of these things positively, but you want to say, hey, the worst thing that could happen is that they continue to do the same thing. You make mistakes, you learn from them.
Nelson, you know, you bring up an interesting point, because there was a lot of discussion, you know, here and everywhere on around the trade deadline of whether the Mets should just tear everything down, trade off everybody, start over, restock the farm system, rebuild, kind of like what the Yankees did a couple of years ago. Obviously, they chose not to do that. What was your opinion going into the trade deadline? Do you think they should have tore it down to the foundation?
Tearing it down to the foundation leaves you at rock bottom. And it for the Yankees, it was a different scenario, because you had the new core five almost at the big league level and ready to go. The guys that could contribute on a daily basis. The Mets don't truly have that. So if you were to, and plus tearing it down means trying to, you know, get rid of guys like Bruce and even trying to get rid of a guy like Cespedes, you couldn't trade them for much value. There was no value. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the players, you know, you have to be healthy to be traded for the amount of, you know, return that you want to start a rebuild from scratch and then to tear it all the way down. It made no sense to do that because you weren't going to get back a lot on your return. So for me, pitching is a premium regardless. And I know we haven't seen the fruits of that with, you know, the five aces that were touted for years and years. And now you got these four guys that you're hoping can carry, you know, the Mets into getting back to where they should be. You need 9 to 10 starters in a championship season. Mm-hmm. That's just a fact. It doesn't happen where, like the Astros, I mean, what, they finally went through to a sixth starter finally because McCullers is out.
Right.
So it doesn't happen. And so you need those quality starters. That gives you your best bet. And we see how well the starters have done. They haven't been winning still. That's the frustrating part, is that if they only got three runs a game, it's a totally different season for a guy like Jacob DeGrom.
Without
a
doubt.
Who should be in the Cy Young talks.
You think he will be? Don't you think he will be anyway?
He should be, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure because when you look at it, and again, these are the baseball writers that do it, and not all of them are very astute in the, you know, reading the numbers into the numbers.
Present company excluded, of course.
Right. Some guys will still go old school.
I understand that, but
wins and losses.
Let's see where Max Scherzer is. Honestly, they'll be like, who's the best of the best? In their head, they'll say they're top five. Right. And they'll say they're top five, and they'll start looking at the numbers. Well, Max Scherzer's got 18 wins. Well, Max Scherzer is third or fourth in ERA. Well, Max Scherzer is leading in strikeouts. Well, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
It's that simple. Whereas you look at somebody like Jacob DeGrom, he might have a losing record. Very well might have a losing record and not get to 10 wins. And it's not fair, but can you really have a Cy Young Award winner who has less than 10 wins?
That's never happened before.
It's going to be interesting because it was King Felix at least had 13 and 12.
Yeah, I was going to say, at least there's a precedent there with Felix Hernandez.
Correct.
That, you know, that wins aren't everything.
Now, Nelson, you bring up the fact that you say this team can compete, or the front office says this team can compete in 2019, and you bring up the fact that they have to start build around these young players. Who are some of these young players that the team can build around? So we can kind of change the narrative a little bit. We can stop focusing on the past and kind of look forward to 2019.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Right now, if you look around at who do you see as key pieces, I mean, Dominic Smith has struggled mightily. I don't think he's someone that's in the plans at all. But again, what return can you get on that investment? The first round draft pick and to trade him, he's kind of going to be one of those guys that you include in a trade and somebody may, you know, be able to take off your hands. You know, Peter Alonso has had a great year down there, but I don't know if they're even going to call him up in September.
Why not?
Guys like McNeil. I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't understand it because he's older than Dominic Smith. You drafted him out of college because of that reason, because he was a more mature type player. You did it with Conforto a few years ago, and he was the spark that really kind of pushed that team in 2015. Even though you had a guy who was a batting champion in left field who, again, was coming off injuries and whatnot and hadn't performed up to that level of ability, but they made the move and let Conforto come up there. Well, I don't know. I really can't understand the Peter Alonso thing, and I'm not sure if it's, you know, the defense, which hasn't been something that they've put paramount over a guy who can absolutely rake, which we've seen Alonso do. But a guy like Peter Alonso, you know, you got McNeil. These are two young guys, McNeil being 26, but when you talk about young, he's missed, you know, huge parts of 3 years due to injuries. Now he's finally healthy and he put up great numbers in the minor leagues, so you have to push him and see what he can do. And I've liked what I've seen thus far. Athletic, he's able to move around at second base especially, so it kind of, he's earmarked right now, you know, as a guy that you could see with the team next year for sure. Brandon Nimmo, which Brandon Nimmo are you going to get for next year? I mean, I love the leadoff type hitter Brandon Nimmo, who takes a bunch of pitches, just fights off some pitches, and is able to hit the ball the other way with occasional pop. I don't like the big swing, you know, high strikeouts. The guy who's leading, you know, the major leagues in the last almost 2 months in strikeouts, that guy isn't the guy that we expect out of Nimmo. You know, Rosario has, again, shown flashes, but it's been difficult to really put his season into perspective, because I don't know if I've ever seen someone who was the number one prospect in baseball come up to the big leagues and have to take days off to kind of learn the game on the fly.
And, you know, I'm sorry, go ahead. I do have a dumb question to ask you next.
Oh, no, never any dumb questions.
Oh, we just wait till you hear it.
So that's the thing with like a guy like Rosario, you see what he can do. You see the tools are there. Now, at 22 years old, was he brought up too quick because everybody clamors for the younger, faster, better? They think everything is going to be that easy for them. For him, maybe another year in AAA to really polish his game all the way around. It, you know, it's one thing to have five tools. It's another thing to be able to use them on a daily basis. That's the most curious one to me is Rosario. I like him. I like him a lot, but he can do the extraordinary. I need someone who can do the ordinary on a daily basis.
That's an excellent point. Now, here's the dumb question. Any chance we see Tim Tebow just to get people in the stands?
No, he's broken hand out for the year.
Oh, that's right. See, it was a dumb question. How dumb was that question?
We saved ourselves. We saved ourselves from this conversation.
And I confirmed that it was a dumb question.
But where do you stand on Tebow? Now we'll follow it up with a, now that we're not going to see him, then where do you stand
with
him?
Will he ever play in the major leagues? Let me amend the question.
You know what? He made the all-star team in AA, and I truly feel that was a PR move. There were guys that were more deserving. It's the minor leagues, and for some of these guys, you know what? It actually matters. They busted their butts. They've been playing, you know, for a lot longer. They've been putting in the work and the effort, and to be recognized as an all-star. I was, you know, king of quadruple A. You know, I still valued the fact that I made short-term goals, I made long-term goals. You know, a short-term goal every year was to pitch well enough to be recognized and represent my team at the All-Star game, to help my team win every single ball game I pitched. So those things you want to be able to do. And so when Tim Tebow gets chosen over guys who have better numbers, you can read right into it. You can't fool people. Everyone knew that it was to put, you know, more ticket sales.
Well, to take that a step further, I mean, you know, obviously he sells tickets, he sells jerseys. If you're playing him above a kid who actually might have a chance, you know, a younger player who has a chance someday to play in the major leagues, that's kind of unfair too, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I mean, I think I look at it at this point. Had he been batting close to 300 and, you know, doing all that, leading the team in hitting, leading the team in home runs, it's like, okay, let's move him up. And because of his age, you kind of want to, you could put him up there, and you could almost defend it to a point and say, hey, he's earned it. To put up average numbers and take him over someone else who, again, has to maybe get protected on the 40-man, a guy who maybe, you know, this is one of those guys that other teams could look at in a trade, those are the kinds of things that really should go into it. I was a guy who got passed over many a year, even though I led my team in every category, the triple crown of pitching, and I would get the, well, you're not on the roster. You know, and
that's
so that
terrible.
Was that's the reality of it. But if it was, you know, Garth Brooks wanted to pitch and they said, hey, Garth Brooks is going to get called up, then, oh yeah, I remember seeing that in spring training and watching that with San Diego. So spring training's one thing, and I get it. You can actually go back and look at Michael Jordan's baseball tenure.
I actually covered him as a minor leaguer his short term.
So you could see, and back then it was deemed almost a failure, like it was a joke. But when you look inside the numbers, and if you look at it in today's game, he had 3 home runs and 51 RBIs. Mm-hmm. He stole over 30 bases. So even though he had a low batting average, which of course he was going to, he hadn't played baseball in so long, there were things that he could do. You look at a guy like Billy Hamilton. Billy Hamilton is very fast, very good defensively, but he can't steal his way onto first base. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were even talking about changing the game and having him come in as almost a reliever to a center fielder who could get on at any point in the game and then put him in so he could steal second and score from second on a single.
Oh,
this way,
Lord.
That was a run a game that he would do, and that was his value to the team. So you could find value in everything. So Michael Jordan wasn't a huge bust for a guy who hadn't played in, you know, 15, 16 years, at least. So for Tim Tebow, You know what? You can see a guy who works hard. You could see a lot of the things, the intangibles. The, you know, there's daily lessons and talks he's having with his teammates who, you know, it, and I don't know how many teammates respect him as a baseball player or respect him as the person that he is.
Yeah, that's the question I was going to ask you. Someone that spent so much time in, or spent a lot of time in the minor leagues, how do they look at a guy like Tebow? Is it someone who can help them, you know, from a mental standpoint, or is it, like you said, someone like, hey, just this guy's taking a spot for me?
Yeah, I you know what? What minor league players don't often realize is that you have zero control. You have zero control over what happens. You know, all it takes is one front office guy that wants a guy up there, and he's up there. It takes. I remember when Daniel Murphy first got called up. He wasn't an outfielder. He went from Double A. He spent one day in Triple A with us at third base, and they needed a left fielder, and they took him up to the big leagues the next day, and they put him in left field. So he was on the fast track because he had a sponsor. He had a guy that believed in him so much that said, you know what, he'll out-hit his defense. And that was how Daniel Murphy's career started. Mm-hmm. So for guys that are down there in the minor leagues and you're busting your butt and you're looking around and you think you know why things are going to happen, you don't actually know. So it makes it difficult. But you have to focus on, I'm doing all I can so that there's 29 other teams that are going to say, we need to give this kid a chance. They're not giving him a chance. Let's get him out of there, whether it's a trade, whether it's Rule 5, whether it's anything of that nature. And so that to me is the speech I always give to any minor leaguers that I ever come in contact with, and they ask me about, you know, what are the things that I need to focus on most? Handling your own business, trying to get better every day. And you want to be the best teammate that you could possibly be, bottom line. And so a guy like Tebow, again, who he is and what he is, I think outweighs anything else in that margin. Now, is he going to prevent a guy who truly deserves calling up or playing time? I don't think so.
Yeah, so do the Mets have someone there? You know, maybe they look at the roster and realize, yeah, we're not going to offend anyone. We're not going to block anyone. So let's bring in a guy that could potentially make us some money in the long run.
And I think more so than anything, that's the thing is when you look at the Mets minor league system at the time and you say, well, we don't have much past, you know, these 6, 7, 8 guys. Mm-hmm. And then you say, well, let's give them an opportunity. It's a good story. It brings attention to the team. And if it's a bust, it's a bust. But they give him an opportunity. I mean, I saw a guy. Let me see, where was this? 2012, I was with the Boston Red Sox. Boston Red Sox signed a gentleman by the name of Shaq Thompson. Mm-hmm. You know who Shaq Thompson is? The linebacker for the Panthers.
Oh, wow.
He went and they tried to make him into a baseball player, and he had 39 at-bats. Mm-hmm. He struck out 37 times in those 39 at-bats.
Wow.
That's something that, you know, there's always something that goes on, but that was, you know, low level where it wasn't a celebrity. It wasn't someone who was, you know.
I would tell you this, Nelson, you know what, writing for the Times, they pretty much stopped covering the Mets at this point, you know, and mm-hmm. you know, much to my displeasure, and I've told them that. But if the Mets were to bring up Tebow, I guarantee the New York Times would be back at Citi Field. So,
oh, yeah.
You know, so I mean, in a way,
so will TMZ, so yeah, will Deadspin,
everybody will be
so
there.
Barstool Sports.
But in a way, it would be to the Mets' advantage because it could change the narrative somewhat. I mean, there's not all that much else, you know, to talk about between now and the end of the season.
Yeah, but not all news is good news.
No, I guess not.
You know,
no.
So you have to be. I think we've learned, you know, and Matt Harvey being back is a perfect way to segue this.
Yeah. Right.
Is that you know what? Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, what'd you think of Harvey coming back yesterday? He seemed like he was contrite. He, you know, was a little more remorseful. What'd you make of the whole Harvey coming back to New York?
I don't think there was anyone that was harder on Harvey on the way out from New York than I was.
Mm-hmm.
And it came from a place of, I mean, I thought he figured it out how to pitch without the plus velocity, how to pitch without the one trick slider, you know, that he could go to at any time and get the strikeout. I thought he learned how to use all his pitches, especially bringing his changeup back. His changeup was probably his most effective pitch, and the pitch that really you know, allowed that slider to work a lot better than it did in the past. And he did that in spring training, and I shook his hand and I told him, you know what, you've become a pitcher again, and I'm proud to see that.
Mm.
then they got then the season hits and he started just going fastball slider heavy and missing his locations and up in the strike zone, couldn't do the things that he was doing in spring training just a few weeks earlier. I saw him against St. Louis live. I sat there with my own eyes, and he went through six innings, gave up the one run on a solo shot, which, so what? It's one run, six innings. I'll take that every day of the week, and he did it against their A squad. So it wasn't, oh, it's spring training, you can't read into it, minor leaguers. He did it against their opening day lineup, pretty much. And he did it with mixing of sliders and changeups back and forth and using his fastball up in the zone and being able to hit that glove side fastball down and away to get a strike and get back in the count. And it was a really good – it was my favorite outing of watching him.
So what does that tell you, though? Does it tell you that maybe he didn't completely buy into that once the season started, that he wasn't really truly confident in pitching that way?
There was a panic involved. Uh-huh. There was a panic, and then his style of pitching – totally changed, and he tried to become a thrower again. And when you reach back for something that's not there, I did that most of my career trying to please people,
right?
Because everyone said if you only threw 2 to 3 miles an hour harder, you would be X, Y, and Z.
Right.
But I could only be who I was, and so I fought it all the time because I was a guy who could use movement, location, move the ball around the strike zone, and mix up pitches. So that 3 times through the lineup, you maybe never saw the same sequence twice. That was my forte. When I see somebody who kind of is grunting for 92 to come out,
right,
instead of being as smooth as possible and trusting that more than 92 is going to come out, that was where I had the issue. And it wasn't a health thing because he – all case and purposes, and he said in every interview, I'm healthy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm healthy. So it was frustrating to watch, and he was kind of just, it just seemed like his body language had been defeated even before he came into games. Even as a reliever trying to do the work, it seemed like he was defeated. I mean, Severino went from a starter who wasn't doing very well, went into being a reliever, mm-hmm. learned how to attack one pitch at a time, and now became the Severino up until the last, you know, 4 or 5 starts.
Right.
But now became the Severino that everybody sees and says, wow. So whether it's going to the bullpen, whether it's going down to the minor leagues and maybe working on a pitch in a different way where, you know what, it's not going to inflate my ERA. It's not going to make the team lose games just because I'm in them working on something. When you're working on something and the rest of the team is trying to win ball games, it's a different element that isn't necessary for the good of the team. It just wasn't.
Yeah.
Yesterday, when he came back and all the words that he said, I saw maturity. I saw a calm. I saw a peace. A very peaceful Matt Harvey who came to terms with, you know what? I did a lot of this on myself.
Hmm.
Do you think that comes with spending a lot of time in Cincinnati? Not much to go on there.
Well, I mean, he may have a lot of time
in the mirror where it really mattered, right?
Yeah, but yeah. He may have needed to get away from New York. I mean, you know, there are a lot of temptations and a lot of ways that a young man with a lot of money can go wrong in this town.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, we've seen it happen to the highest of stars. I mean, we've seen it happen to guys who just get enamored by it. But what it did was it fed him in a way, and I think what really did it was the booze.
Mm-hmm.
Not being used to the booze. And like he said, everything he did was to try and be that guy that everyone remembered as the, you know, almost throwing a perfect game every single time with 10 punch outs. And if he didn't have the 10 punch outs, it's almost as if he didn't pitch a good enough game.
Yeah.
I went nuts because I said he could have been as a number 3, number 4, number 5 starter even. So what? But if he goes out there, and I never went out there with the mentality that I'm a spot starter, number 5 starter, or I shouldn't be here on the mound today.
Right.
I went out there with the mentality that, you know what? If I keep my team in a ball game, give up 3 runs or less through 6 innings, that means we got a chance to win this game. And that's all I was asking out of him, was a 4.5 ERA. And people argued with me, oh, my God, a 4.5 ERA, that's terrible. And I said, well, do me a favor and go to Fangraphs and look up the top 30 ERAs in baseball last year for starters. And a 4.5 is right about there.
Huh.
Top 30. So if every team has an ace, that's 30 aces not pitching to a 4.5 ERA. So it was very plausible. It was something that I think he could have done. I think he would have had more good games than bad games, but that he was having terrible games, one after another, after another, after another, and no sign of coming out of it, because the words that were coming out of his mouth were, you know, I feel like I'm close. I feel like I threw a really good a good slider today,
right,
and made a good pitch.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, he gave up 6 runs.
Yeah, I saw some of that too, you know, near the end of his Mets tenure. I mean, in part of it, Nelson, weren't the Mets kind of enablers in terms of making each one of his starts such a huge event and almost like anointing him as like he was another Tom Seaver before he had really done that? I mean, he had some terrific games in 2014 and 2015, but do you think it was too much too soon in a way?
It was a lot of pressure, and it was. And I think when you looked at it and you looked at his numbers, I mean, we kept putting up full screens, you know, all the time of where Matt Harvey ranks currently in Mets history,
right,
through his first, you know, 25 starts. And it was like, because when he was good, he was very good.
Yeah,
you're talking about giving up one run or less.
Yeah, yes, but you're setting a standard now that a guy's got to try to keep up every time. Yeah, that's
right.
Tough.
And I think he was able to do it even when he came back from Tommy John, but it was the second surgery where it really took a toll on him. And physically, we know what it was. I mean, anyone who's had surgery knows how you don't come back the same. But mentally, and he admitted that yesterday, mentally how tough it was to try and live up to that.
Sure. Yeah, I think there's no doubt about that.
I mean, but honestly, did people expect him to go out there and go, I'm not the Dark Knight. I don't want to be a superhero. I don't want people screaming Harvey's better. You know, actually, think about it. Cespedes said it the year after they went to the World Series, and he was his first injury. And when he was coming back, he was struggling a little bit, and he said, I'm not Superman.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's hard for some guys to say that, though, and I don't think Harvey was a guy who could do that.
Right, no, without a doubt. And I think the mental aspect of it is where, I never had a 98-mile-an-hour fastball. I never was drafted, you know, number one. I was never able to do the things that Matt Harvey could do. But I can tell you what it's like to get booed off the mound. I could tell you what it's like to get knocked around and have to figure out another way of pitching to continue to get out. I could tell you what it's like to come back from surgery. So that mental side of it that he speaks of, I understood. Mm-hmm. I understood about, and I even understood about getting booed when I came back to Citi Field. You know, my first night when I came in to pitch, I got a standing ovation. Then, you know, I said some things in the paper about how things are different where I'm at with Philadelphia, and I got booed off the mound the next night.
Oh, boy.
So you kind of learn that these fans can be the best, and these fans really love their team. You can't say anything bad about their team.
Well,
so Matt Harvey even said he gave 100% of what he was to this team and to being a New Yorker.
The first Met to throw a shutout in Citi Field, Nelson Figueroa.
That's right.
Yeah, there you go.
See that? I'm sure they cheered you that night.
Starbucks.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Hey, Nelson, thanks so much. We kept you way longer than we expected to. We really appreciate the time today and the insights. And we look forward to listening to you on SNY.
Anytime. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you. Thanks
all
so righty. Much, man.
Nelson Figueroa, okay. Great insights on
awesome.
Matt Harvey.
Yeah.
You know, when you've been the Dark Knight, it's tough to, like, suddenly realize that you're not anymore.
Isn't it funny how the big reason I wanted to get Nelson on was to talk about 2019, talk about the future of the Mets. We spent the majority of the time talking about Harvey and Tebow. It's just how the Mets, it's just what it is now with the Mets. It's the narrative of the Mets is what went wrong and what's the latest side circus.
Because nobody, I think, knows how to fix it. And
exactly.
I think, you know, Nelson pretty much admitted that.
Yeah, so special shout out to Seth Edelstein, my former colleague at CBS Sports, and he's also a producer at SNY for getting me in contact with Nelson Figueroa.
Yeah.
Someone we wanted to get on the podcast for a while.
Yeah, great get. All right, Dan, this is a lady that we have wanted to have on since the beginning of the season.
Yeah, the fans demanded it.
People are clamoring to hear from Meredith Marakovic, who is I guess, what do we call her, the sideline reporter for the Yankees? Or
sideline extraordinaire. She spends a lot of time in the booth, too.
Absolutely. I mean, she's all over the place. She's in the clubhouse before the game, which you don't see a lot of sideline reporters or television commentators doing. She's in there. Susan Waldman's in there. They ask the right questions. They talk to the players. They know the teams as well as anybody. So we're very happy to have you on the NYNY Baseball Pod today, Meredith. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. And who are these fans? I feel like you guys are filling up a lot of lies already
yeah.
on this podcast.
No, just take our word
keep
for it.
We get tweets. Once we had Susan on, and you know, and everyone's like, well, we want to hear from Meredith too. We want to hear about, you know, the ladies of the Yankees broadcast teams.
So there we go.
I like it.
So yesterday, all right, terrible weekend in Boston. I mean, really, perhaps catastrophic for, you know, the AL East division. But last night, the Yankees came back and won, and I'm sure it's more pleasant to do a post-game interview with a guy like Didi after the Yankees win than, you know, after a debacle that they had, you know, Thursday through Sunday.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, anybody, that's not selective to Didi, anyone in that clubhouse. And I have to tell you, Sunday night after that loss could have been the quietest I had heard that clubhouse all season long. And, hey, do you blame them after going into a series against the Red Sox where they were hoping to make up ground and really be in the thick of it for the AL East? They wind up getting swept. 9.5 games back when they leave or more, and you wouldn't think they'd want to talk after that. I mean,
no.
What would you say after that? There's not much to say after that. You're not at that point in time with 2 months of baseball left to be played going to say, hey, we think we lost the division in this series. At the same time, you know, you can't be unicorns and rainbows after a game or games like that where you've just struggled, the whole team has struggled. And it wasn't really that series in particular. I mean, that series was bad, but if you look at the course of the last 6 weeks, the Yankees have been semi-average when it comes to, mm-hmm. to the results. They've been a 500 team. They just haven't been playing well.
So if the game's not on YES, which was on ESPN, you're still obligated to go into the clubhouse, get sound and whatnot?
So we have a post-game show called YES Extra Innings when it's national. So on the road, I will be, yes, in that clubhouse talking to guys after the win or loss. Yes is nice in the fact that at home, a lot of times, if it's a national game, they'll give me the day off, which is nice. I'm able to get a break here or there. But I'll still be good for about 145 to 148 games, plus spring training and playoffs. So
wow.
I get my fair share in.
I got to tell you one thing about Meredith, all right? I covered the team day in and day out for 8 years. And after a while, the travel just kills me. And when the season ends, I don't want to go on an airplane. And I'll tell my wife and kids, we can go on vacation if we can get there by car. Meredith, in the middle of the season, will jump on an airplane and like to go to Australia for a couple of days.
I follow Meredith on Instagram, and your Instagram stories, I'm like, where in the world is Meredith Marakovic today?
I don't
today?
Know how you do it. I really don't. And I've said this to you. You know the way I think about traveling, and how do you do it?
I just, you know, I'm good for like 24 hours after a long stretch of work. I'm like, yeah, you know, I should really relax and lay low. And then I get bored. I'm like, oh, this is, what am I doing here? I'm wasting time. I feel like if I'm not doing something productive or seeing something new or, you know, going off and visiting people, I feel like I'm wasting time. So that's why I'm kind of jet-setting around a little bit.
It's amazing.
And I feel like now is the time to do it. You know, I have the opportunity to do so. And I will tell you this, though, Wally. I low-keyed it this All-Star break. I was going to go to Peru to do Machu Picchu. And then I looked at it and I was like, even for me, that's absurd. What are you doing with your life right now? You do not need to go to Peru for 5 days in the middle of the season.
So what'd you do?
What does laying low for Meredith consist of?
You know what? I went to Florida. I went to Clearwater for a couple of days, and I went to Miami for a couple of days. So it was very low-key by my standards.
So when you do have a day off, it's what? If you work in 150 games, so there's 12 games that you're not covering the Yankees. Do you keep track of the Yankees? Do you find yourself looking at your phone, seeing what's going on?
Of course. I mean, I think that – and that's a lot of the reason why I work so much as well. For me, it's easier if I'm there all the time. When you start taking big chunks of time off in the middle of the season, I feel like I'm missing something, so I'm watching – and reading and doing everything you should do if you have this job anyway. So in my mind, I rationalize it as, what's the point of really even having off? I'm not really off. I'm still doing the things I would essentially be doing if I'm working. So I will say when I do get time off, a lot of times when I am watching or listening, it's from a beach. So I love MLB.com. MLB app is really a savior. So you can be in some maybe better locales doing that. But no, I'm still pretty dialed in.
Always felt that way. I mean, you know, now that I don't cover the team on the road, when they come back from a road trip, I feel like I've missed like, you know, a whole semester of graduate school and I have to catch up again.
Yeah, and you know what? Well, it's the little things, too, the things that maybe don't matter to anyone else or maybe don't even matter in general. But if you're not there, you don't always see who got up in the seventh inning but didn't get in the game. Or you don't always see, you know, something that happens post-game. You only see what they televise and you only hear what's written in stories. So you don't know the other half of what goes on for the day. And I don't like all the time missing some of that stuff because I think it shapes the narrative. So
I find
it difficult if I'm gone for a while. I don't like that feeling when I get back. And it's nice in the fact that with what I do, I'm asking the first question. So that's good in some regards. In other regards, if you've been gone for a week, it's not as great because you don't feel like you're in the mix like you should be.
Let me say something else about Meredith. She has to carry the ball very often. A lot of times, a lot of us, and I include myself in this, like, I just don't feel like asking a question today. Just let Meredith do it. And she does it. And I don't know how you come up with one question after another. I've always admired that about you. I'm sure it's very difficult to come up with a question after a tough loss when you have to get a player on the field still in the heat of battle. But I mean, how do you come up with so many questions? I mean, do you pre-write things? Do you have things that are prepared or let's say subjects of discussion that you're going to want to hit, or do you actually write out questions?
I don't write out questions, but I mean, I pay attention to the game. I hear that's step one in trying to go.
It helps to watch. Yeah,
that's good.
Step one, watch the game. Step two, if you're so inclined, score the game. And then, you know, I'll make little notes on my score sheet as I go along of things that happen to kind of jog my memory because, you know, sometimes people are not all that talkative and you're expecting a long, you know, thoughtful response and instead you get four words and you're like, oh no, now what? Like, where am I going next? I can't do anything with that. So you have an idea of where you want to go and, you know, the on-field interviews in particular, you don't have a lot of time there and you can't really expand the way you would in the clubhouse. So you have maybe four bullet points in your head and that could change depending on what the answers are, how the person responds. But you get three, maybe four if there's a translator. Sometimes I only get two questions. So those tend to be more generic and reactionary on the emotion of the win. Mm-hmm. And then in the clubhouse, you're able to kind of ask a little bit more as far as whether it be strategy or specific plays or dive into that a little bit.
Yeah, last night you had CeCe, I saw on the Yes post game, you had to talk to him about, obviously his last start wasn't that great. And I think you worded it so I was like, you know, last outing, you know, you weren't at your best. That must be hard to kind of just say that to someone and then have to follow up with a question.
Yeah, especially after a Yankees win, after they had lost five straight. And, you know, you don't want to be overly negative, but you also have to be realistic. So I found over the years, if you stick to the facts, somebody can't get that mad at you. If you start kind of inserting your own opinion in your question, and while you'll attest to this, there are people that do that, and they really rub people the wrong way. And hey, that's your prerogative. Everybody has a different approach, and I'm not saying one is right and one is wrong. But for me, I like to, I'm trying to think of the CC thing. I think I said something along the lines of, hey, I know that last outing, you didn't last as long as you might have liked.
Right.
Something along, instead of, why did you only go three in it, you know, something like that.
Well,
there's a more delicate way to word it, I think, that people appreciate. You don't have to do it that way, but I think over the course of a long season, you wear people down if you do it the other way.
Right. Absolutely. And here's the thing you have to remember. I mean, you know, I came from a different background. I covered boxing where the questions are just a lot more direct. I mean, honestly. And
Mike Tyson, why'd you bite that guy's ear?
Exactly. You just ask a guy like that, or how could you lose to this guy? You just say something like that. Now, when I came onto the Yankee beat, I would ask questions like that, and I got guys a little ticked off. And then I realized you had to be more diplomatic. And I listened to other people, not, you know, people like Meredith and other people who have been around ballplayers, and you do have to kind of couch your terms a little bit. And you have to remember that your job is to get an answer, not to piss the other guy off or to make yourself the story. You're there to get an answer out of a guy, right? And I think that's something that you do very well.
And one of my favorite things is, especially after Yankees losses, social media. Sometimes a great thing, sometimes not such a great thing. But I really thoroughly enjoy after something crazy happens in the game, right? And you go in there post-game, you ask the question. The people don't like the answer. Right. So because they don't like the answer, they don't acknowledge that the question was asked. It's like, right. I asked the question. The question was asked three different ways. Because you don't accept the answer does not mean that it wasn't addressed. It just means that you don't like the answer. Like, people get kind of out of their minds with stuff sometimes. But,
or they want you to ask it in a way that's ridiculously combative. Like, you know, how stupid is Boone right. for not bunting
right.
the
Sunday night. Sunday night might have been a prime example of that, where people were upset because Boone was too positive in the clubhouse after getting, you know, beat down in Boston.
Right, right. Well, what are you going to say? My season's over. We're still 20-plus games over 500, and we have a better record than anyone in the National League. We have more wins than anyone in the National League. I mean, yes, it's been bad lately, but this is still a very good baseball team. And I think we've seen in years past where there was maybe a little bit of a different approach, and I don't know how well that approach worked either. It's clear that the Yankees went in a different direction with Boone. He's more of a laid-back guy. He's more of a, I'm not going to panic immediately. I'm not going to be stressed out. And whether he is privately, you know, we don't know that exactly. But, you know, he's been cool, calm, and collected regardless of what's happened this season. And for the most part, the Yankees have responded pretty well to that.
Very, very, very different from Joe Girardi. I mean, obviously, Girardi had his pluses and his minuses as well. But I do agree with you. I think that Boone creates a more relaxed atmosphere, not only in the clubhouse, but among the media. I mean, I've never seen him become defensive at a question. And, you know, you would know this better than me because you've asked him more questions than I have this season. But I haven't seen him ridicule a question or be condescending to a questioner. And I think that changes in some ways the way the team is covered.
I think so as well. I think so as well. I think less people are maybe on the attack. It's hard to really gauge because this is their first real bump of the season.
True.
Should it be a prolonged thing where they're really subpar, maybe something changes. I haven't seen anything in Aaron Boone that leads me to believe that that would change. But, you know, if you went through something really catastrophic, you wonder if he's able to keep up that same demeanor. But well, all signs.
He hasn't had that kind of a test yet, and that's an excellent point. You know, we'll see how he reacts when he's truly tested that way. But Meredith, can you take us – the fans would love to get a behind-the-scenes look of what it's like to be with the Yankees and the times that the public doesn't get to see them. Obviously, you get to go on the team plane with them. You spend time – and I brought up Didi because I know you spend time with him in Curacao. You get to know these guys on a different level than even I do or my compatriots in the newspaper business. What's it like to be on the team plane? Is there a lot of interaction or do basically the players stay by themselves and the media stay by, you know, keep to themselves?
I have to be honest with you. There's not a ton of interaction. I mean, there's hellos and, you know, a couple words exchanged here or there, but the media is in the back of the plane. So those guys really don't have much of a reason to come to the back of the plane.
Right.
Meredith,
so you'll see guys
this is not the answer we wanted.
I know. I'm
we
not
want to hear like some crazy
want.
Like WWE story, like they're flipping tables and they're gambling and, you know, Giancarlo's got Torres in a headlock. Come on.
No, none of that. I mean, you know, after wins, obviously guys are a little more amped up than perhaps after losses. There are a section of the plane where some guys do like to play games and play cards in that area. And then there's some of the guys that just like to sleep and mind their own business. And then the coaching staff is all the way in the front of the plane talking about game planning for the next series. It's not as exciting and as wild as I think you'd like to believe it is. I also think that 25 years ago, it was a much different story. I
think plus the newspaper guys were on that.
Yeah, I think things have changed a lot in way of preparation and taking care of your body and all that stuff, where maybe there's not some of the crazy behavior that goes on, like people drinking 25 beers
Boxies.
On a plane on a cross-country flight, you know?
Boxies,
I don't know that that goes on as much anymore.
Well, someone you do fly with is Susan Waldman, John Sterling. You spend a lot of time Susan, and we ask every guest we have on this show that spends a lot of time with John Sterling if you have any Sterling stories for us. That's a hashtag that we use now, Sterling stories.
Oh God, where do I begin? I wouldn't even know where to begin with that.
You notice I didn't ask that one.
Yeah, right.
Oh. Well, how about...
Man, he is one of a kind. I have to tell you, he's one of a kind, and he makes me smile every day because he'll come in our booth and he'll say, "Mary, oh, that is a lovely outfit." You know, he'll say something nice every day. He's just an adorable character, and I wouldn't even know how to describe him. He's just so different.
He's a unique individual. He certainly is.
He beats by the sound of his own drum, and I can appreciate that. Yeah. I can appreciate that.
Well, how about Susan? I know that she is a role model for you. She's a trailblazer. We had her on this podcast, and she told us stories that we couldn't believe. You know, back in the 80s, needing police escorts, players spitting on her. And it was mind-boggling to hear that type of stuff. So, you know, what's your experience been like with Susan, and, is she a role model for you?
Susan and others are the reason that people don't do that to me. Now, I think there's still stuff that goes on that people would be so surprised about, but overall, compared to those days, things have improved. As far as Susan, she's always been very good to me. She and I will hang out on the road a little bit. You know, we're the only two females that travel with the Yankees, so there's a little bit of a sisterhood there. We actually have a trip coming up to Seattle. Susan and I are going to have ourselves a nice little day. Her birthday is coming up, so
that's right.
We're going to go hiking. We're going to go to a spa. Then we're going to do a little wine tasting.
Wow.
We like to do stuff like that on the road. You know, Wally, you said it. I can't sit still, so that's a prime example of not just taking a day and relaxing. Well, it'll be relaxing, but you know, you got to fill up the day.
Yeah.
Susan,
the game's not enough,
huh? Susan told me coming into this season that she wants to do more adventurous things. She wants to do more because I'm always doing like weird stuff on the road.
That's
whether
great.
It be San Francisco, I'll bike ride over the Golden Gate, or I usually in every city I'll find something.
I know. I was supposed to do that with you one year, but I think I may have stayed out too late the night before, and I didn't make it.
Just gonna say what happened. Well, here's the thing, Wally.
Let's get to the bottom of this right now.
I was out with you, I believe, and I still went.
Yeah.
Wow.
I wasn't gonna mention that part. Yeah, we were out late, and I got beat up, and Susan was just fine and went the next day. I mean, Meredith was just fine and went.
Well, Meredith, when you do all these activities during the day, do you ever, like, get to the stadium and you're beat, or is that when the coffee comes into play?
I can answer that. I've never seen that. Never seen that.
No, and you know what? Oh, go ahead, Wally.
No, I was going to say I've never seen you like that, but I would. You know what? Let me just give you a little bit of Meredith's background. You know that she was a college volleyball
player.
Yes,
I saw that.
Terrific athlete. And we were going to do a beat writer Olympics once.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, there's no way I'm playing volleyball unless I am on Meredith's
team. Unless you're wearing a helmet.
No, and then our history was we were actually teammates for one year at ESPN, right? You were at that point doing the radio updates for them on the Yankees. And I was covering the team. And then did you go to Philadelphia to cover the Sixers?
Yes, I covered the Sixers for 2 years. I've worked at, what's it even called now, NBC Boston, or it was CSN New England at the time. I worked SNY, CSN New England, Comcast Sportsnet in Philly, basically the whole East Coast.
So how did it come about that you came back to the Yankees then? Who made the approach, and how long did it take you to say yes?
So I was covering the Sixers at the time, but prior to getting that job, it was 2010, I want to say, 2009, 2010. Before I took the ESPN radio job, I interviewed for a position that was open with the YES Network for the Nets sideline gig.
Mm-hmm.
And it was between myself and someone else. And I was pretty young at the time, and I wound up not getting that job. And I asked them, is there anything I could have done differently? Blah, 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 the whole shebang. And they said, no, we really liked you. She just had more experience in New York City. At the time, I was clearly heartbroken because I was so close to what I thought was a big job. I'd later learned that I think the Nets won, what, 9 games that year? 11
yeah,
games
I think
that year.
I think things worked out better for you.
Yeah, maybe it was a blessing in disguise. I then took the ESPN radio job, and because I was in New York, I would run into the Yes people every now and again. And then when I left, I was covering the Sixers, and I saw that Kim Jones had left. I reached out to my agent and said, hey, I want to get back into baseball. And then it kind of just went from there. They remembered me. I came in. I mean, it was a long process as far as them narrowing it down and looking at a lot of candidates. And fortunately for me, it worked out. I'm trying to think of who else was in the mix for that, but I wound up leaving the Sixers early that year to take the Yankees job. So it was kind of crazy the way it all went down. Never even been to the Yes Network studio. Wow. I had been to the office, but not the studio. And I was covering the Sixers. They were down in Miami. So I actually was in Philly, went to Miami, went back to Philly, went to Tampa to meet the crew, went back to Philadelphia, then went to Miami they were playing the Marlins in that opener when the stadium opened, went there. My flight got canceled, so I didn't even make it there for that game. I essentially got there in like the fourth inning. And then
sounds like a weekend for you.
Finished out a Miami Sixers game. So I was in Florida, like flying back and forth like 5 times in the course of a week or something insane.
Wow.
And then my first game, I didn't even cover a spring training game. My first game was against the Tampa Bay Rays. Mariano Rivera blows a save. And I was like, hi, guys, I'm Meredith. Nice to meet you. What's up?
What did you say to Mo?
Good to see you.
Yeah.
Good to see you. Oh, God, I don't even remember. I would say the only thing I had going for me is the fact that I was there a bit in 2010. So people,
they knew you.
I think, knew me a little bit. Yeah. I wasn't somebody totally new and clueless.
Yeah.
So that was helpful. And then I think they went from Tampa to Baltimore. All my stuff was in Philly. I rented a car in Baltimore, picked up my clothes in Philadelphia, and stayed in like a rental apartment for like a month.
God,
until I found
the glamorous life of a television baseball broadcaster.
Glamour.
How long did it take?
Glamour.
Go ahead.
I was going to say even more glamorous when we got in at 5 a.m. on Monday. That was glamorous.
Oh, yeah, after the lovely ESPN Sunday night game, which I'm a huge fan of. Not. I was going to say, how long did it take the fans to accept you as part of the team? I mean, because you know how difficult it is to give fans somebody new. Now, here you are suddenly, you're Kim Jones now after she had done it for a couple of years. Did it take a while for the fans to accept you?
I think it took maybe a little bit of time, but overall the fans have been very good to me from day one, so I'm thankful for that. And I do find as time goes on, you know, more and more people will reach out to me and say stuff to me. But I think overall they've been fantastic and definitely more positive than negative. I think the toughest thing in this business, and Wally, I'm sure you know this from doing radio and from writing, you have to accept the fact that not everybody is going to like you.
If you can't deal with that, you can't do this.
You hope that more people like you than don't, but there are going to be some people that maybe aren't that into you,
right?
You know, and that's their prerogative. But overall, I've had a lot of positive feedback, and I really enjoy interacting with the fans at the ballpark. I actually, the last 2 years, they did women's fantasy camp down in Tampa, which
was
a great time.
Wow, what's that
so
like?
So I got to meet some hardcore Yankees fans that actually get to, you know, play for a weekend and take part in that. So I get to interact with them there. But I do find as time's going on, especially with how good this team has been, the surprise a little bit of last year and then this year, there's just so much more emphasis on the Yankees, I think, and so much more interest, I guess would be a better word, that I think more people are paying attention.
I always had a question for you.
And as a result,
I always had a question for you, and it has to do with the Gatorade baths. First of all, you do a great job. Sometimes you don't even stop the question. You just go right through it. So a lot of guys jump out of the way. Who pays for like the dry cleaning? Does Yes pick that up, or is that something you have to expense?
I don't think I've expensed dry cleaning.
It's a hard-hitting question.
It used to be, so a couple years ago, it used to be Brett Gardner all the time. And I'd literally walk over to him and say, you owe me whatever, whatever. He'd smile and laugh and say, okay. And I honestly believe that if I brought in a receipt, he'd probably pay me.
Yeah.
But it's all in good fun. But the dry clean, the Gatorade isn't as bad. A lot of that is washable.
What about the champagne?
Well, that's what kills you. I ruined a pair of sneakers last year, a coat, a couple things. Couple things got ruined last year. Not if you wash that right away, you might have a shot. But we went from, where was it? We went from Cleveland to Houston, 3+ hour flight, I think that was.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was drenched, like absolutely drenched. But to my credit, I had the wherewithal to bring other clothes, knowing that I probably was going to get drenched. Yeah. So I put all my stuff in a plastic bag, and then it sat there in Houston for like 4 days.
Oh, so it smelled great.
It was like, there's no chance.
And you don't have the option. You don't have the option that we do. You know, a lot of us in the print media stay back, you know, like give them a few minutes to shoot all the champagne before we go in there. You
got
to go right
in.
Yeah, that's not good. But you've gotten pretty good at sidestepping the Gatorade bath, I've noticed. You do have a way of eluding. Yeah, you could elude it a little bit. I've noticed.
Yeah, there's actually a sideline reporter off-season agility program that everybody goes through. You have to pass it to get the job.
Yeah.
No kidding. But, you know, it is like you see it coming sometimes, depending on where they're coming from. You see it coming. But you have to make that decision. Oh, man, do I give it away and stay dry? Or do I try to hang in there a little bit to make it a bit of a surprise for the player, and then I could get hit with some residual Gatorade.
That's a very tough decision.
You know, everybody has to make their own decisions in life, right?
Yep. Meredith, before we let you go, one last question, and you brought up the fact that you're on the field for some very big moments, none bigger than the end of Derek Jeter's career when he had that big walk-off hit, or even his 3,000th hit. And when you go into those, and while touched on whether you have a prepared question in mind, you know, the pressure must be insane to come up just to kind of capture that moment. Take us back to Jeter's last hit at Yankee Stadium, and you get on that microphone and it goes out to the entire stadium. Is there, feel like it's got to be a lot of pressure?
So I come in from the third base side walking over, and you know, you watch it all unfold, and you're a little bit of you is thinking like, this really didn't just happen like this. Of course it did, it's Derek Jeter. But you have that disbelief as well just watching it. And I remember Jeter went to shortstop, and then, you know, he went to his parents. He saw his nephew, Jaden, and then he just looked at me and said, like, all right, I'm ready. I'm ready. And you could hear a pin drop the moment that Mike came over the loudspeaker at Yankee Stadium. It was just crazy, like everybody clinging to his last words of whatever he had to say. It was so eerily quiet in the stadium. That's what I remember from that. And the emotion that he spoke with and kind of trying to hold back some tears of the moment. But as far as being nervous or thinking about the questions, to me, and it sounds weird, like it was just another day at the office. It was just another walk-off win, and you don't realize until after it happens really the magnitude of it. Like, I mean, I had text messages from so many people. I didn't even at the time, I mean, I knew everybody was picking it up, but I didn't really grasp it at the time that this was like worldwide. This was like a big thing worldwide that everybody was watching this moment. So I think it's one of those, like, looking back, it was cool. That was amazing. It was a neat opportunity for me to be a part of Yankees history in that way. But as it was unfolding and as it was happening, it was just another day of work. Like, you realize,
and you did an amazing job with it. I mean, it was almost like the equivalent, our equivalent of the Lou Gehrig speech, really. I mean, you know, that's the closest that we'll get to see to that. So.
Yeah, I mean, it was a pretty cool moment. It was pretty remarkable. And looking back on it, you know, I've since watched it since then and been like, wow,
now you appreciate it. All right, listen, you may have more of those this October. Let's see what happens with this team. You know, I kind of think they're headed for the wild card now, but you know, at the very least, we're going to get one playoff game and maybe more, and you'll be right in the thick of it. So, Meredith, thanks so much for joining us today, and I guess I'll see you, unless you're flying off to, like, you know, Indonesia or something.
Are you going to
Peru
anytime
soon? Maybe I'll see you this weekend.
No, I'll be there this weekend. I do have a couple days off before that Miami series, so you know me, Wally.
Yes.
Schedule.
Yeah, don't waste any time now, Meredith, because the time is at a premium.
Guys,
so I'll see you at Yankee Stadium this weekend. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Meredith.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
All right,
that was great. Meredith Marakovic, I tell you what, she's a fixture of that broadcast team now. It's the one person who's almost always there. You know, like the Yes Booth rotates. Mm-hmm. You know, today it's Kay, tomorrow it's Rucco, it's O'Neill, it's Cohn, it's Leiter. Meredith's always there.
I was actually surprised. I was going to ask her how many games she works. We know that Kay, because his contract is now like public knowledge that he does 125.
Is it really? How much is he making?
$2 million a year.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That hurts.
Yeah, Michael Kay. So he does 125 games a year. I was actually really surprised to learn that Meredith does like close to 150.
That's a lot.
That
I'm
is insane.
You,
plus
man.
Spring training.
Yeah.
So it was really nice to hear, you know, the behind the scenes stuff that a lot of fans just they turn on Yes and they see her, you know, do her sideline report or do her report from the third base line, but they don't know everything that goes into it. The traveling and the like she said the champagne filled clothes and living in apartments for 30 days at a time, going from city to city. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's a grind. And it's not nearly as glamorous as it looks, you know, on the air. And the other thing is, as I said, unlike a lot of broadcasters, and I'm not going to mention any names, who do not do a lot of pregame research, she is in that clubhouse when it opens every single game, as is Susan Waldman.
Yeah, you see it right in her work, and she's very prepared, and that's why I think a lot of the fans have taken such a liking to Meredith. So special shout-out to Meredith Marakovic for joining us on the podcast. We're going to wrap up the show today, but see this, Wally, before we say goodbye, we have a fan all the way in Venezuela that listens
to us. Yes, 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 yes. And he was having some trouble hearing it in Venezuela, but he apparently worked out the technical problems, and he's with us now.
Yeah, so shout out to the Ghost Settlers, Emmy, for listening to us all the way in Venezuela. We're tweeting with him yesterday. He says, it's Venezuela, the home of Glaber. So he tunes in every single week, and with a special shout out to him for listening all the way in Venezuela. How about that, Wally?
That's great.
Yeah, and also Don LaGreca. We got to the bottom of the beef.
Did we get to the bottom of it?
I don't know if we really got to the bottom. I was watching, or I was just like flipping through the channels yesterday, and I got a text from my brother, our super producer, Nick, that they just mentioned the podcast on the Michael Kay Show, which is now like a daily occurrence. They mentioned the podcast, and it was the Don LaGreca and your beef that we talked about with Michael
Kay. I don't have a beef with LaGreca.
This fake beef.
He's got a beef with me.
All right, so that's what I'm talking about. He's got a beef for you. So I'm going to go back to LaGreca and say that you got a beef with him.
But I don't.
But he has a beef with you.
I like Don.
So we're not to the bottom of it.
No, we're not to the bottom of it at all. I still don't understand it.
But we're going to get to the bottom of it, then I'm going to have to tweet Rosenberg again. But it was nice to hear them mention it once again.
Yeah, well, you know, if it helps the podcast, keep mentioning it.
Yeah.
Keep mentioning it. We have a beef. One of these days, LaGreca, I'm going to kick your butt.
There it is. You heard it here first. What we got coming up? The Yankees you know, have a 27-game stretch against a bunch of teams under 500. They're going to try to get back on track. We got the 1998 celebration coming up, which Derek Jeter will not be at.
No kidding. He's probably very, very busy rebuilding the Miami Marlins.
Yeah, that's now he's going to be his excuse why he's never going to show up to another old-timers day. He's never
I'm running a baseball
another.
Team, buddy.
Well, next year they're going to have the 20th anniversary of the 99 team. The year after that they're going to have the 20th anniversary of the 2000 team.
He was on all those teams,
right,
wasn't
so
he?
So will we see Jeter showing up to Yankee Stadium anytime soon? What do you think?
No. If he's not showing up for this one, why would he show up for 1999?
The best team of all time, the 1998 Yankees, arguably, and he doesn't show up. Now he has this built-in excuse now with the Marlins. We're not going to see Jeter for a long time.
He's a busy man.
Yeah. All right. So that's it. We're a busy man, too. We're going to head out of here. Go on with their week while you'll be covering the Yankees and the Mets, or maybe just the Yankees.
Probably just the Yankees, the way things are going.
Something drastic happens with the New York Mets, but that's it. We'll be back next week for another edition of the New York Baseball Podcast.